Trade and tariffs, of course, kind of have to do those. Initial public offerings as well. And we'll do a little rock climbing, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 9th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We present to you today two distinct snapshots of the global economy. Snapshot number one came to us from the Commerce Department this morning, the monthly report on the trade deficit. It was about what we expected. The headline number increased or expanded in March just a little bit as we bought more from overseas than we sold abroad. But with the trading partner that is top of mind right now, Chinese officials are in Washington as we speak trying to work out a deal. With China, our trade imbalance actually narrowed. So with those as headlines, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains the big picture.
The overall trade deficit getting bigger isn't necessarily bad, according to Dan Eikenson at the Cato Institute.
It just so happens that when the economy grows, we tend to see the trade deficit increase.
A boost in imports often reflects companies importing materials to make other products, or American consumers buying more stuff from all over the world.
Imports are really complements to U.S. domestic production. They're not substitutes for U.S. domestic production.
The trade numbers also give us a snapshot of what's happening on the export side of things. For example, American companies shipped fewer aircrafts internationally in March, just about the time we were learning about all the problems with Boeing's 737 MAX. Mary Lovely is an economics professor at Syracuse University.
This could be continuing drag on U.S. exports moving forward. You know, Boeing is one of our largest exporters.
Also important, agricultural exports. They've taken a beating in the trade war with China, especially soybeans. But soybean exports to China were actually up almost 40% in March.
That is in part due to the agreement where China would begin to start up with some purchases of soybeans.
Whether that boost will last, says Lovely, depends a lot on what happens during ongoing trade talks. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Macroeconomic snapshot number two today is out of the bond market. The Department of the Treasury holds regular auctions of U.S. debt, Treasury bills and bonds. You got to fund all that deficit spending somehow, right? And the auction yesterday of 10-year Treasuries, bonds whose yields influence everything from mortgages to student loans, was interesting because those 10-year notes drew the lowest investor demand we have seen in 10 years. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains what's going on there.
Bond auctions are kind of like an art auction at Christie's, just electronic and way more boring.
All the auctions happen once a month. They are on regularly scheduled days, and that's to promote certainty and regular participation.
That's Jim Vogel at FTN Financial. He says regular participation helps promote fair and steady prices. But when demand dries up at a bond auction, yields can shoot higher. Chuck Tomes at Manulife Investment Management says not only that.
The up move you could see in yields could be that much more dramatic in a short period of time.
Yields did jump after Wednesday's auction. But overall, long-term bond yields have been low. So low that a 10-year bond doesn't really pay investors that much more than a short-term bond. Putri Pasquale at PAMCO Prisma says that doesn't exactly entice investors.
I'm not getting paid that much more to lock up my money for 10 years, so why would I do that?
She says foreign buyers have also been reducing their purchases of U.S. bonds, partially because of the strong dollar. But Jim Vogel at FTN Financial says there's a bigger reason for that poor showing yesterday.
Given all the equity turmoil and the concentration on U.S.-China trade negotiations this week, it's not totally surprising that the Treasury auction struggled the way it did.
Vogel says investors have been running to the safety of government bonds all week. By the time yesterday's auction kicked off, investors who wanted bonds already had them. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
In equities today, stocks that is really ugly early. And then the White House said some nice things about a possible deal with China, and traders went, oh, okay, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. sometimes the ticker symbol for a newly tradable stock can be pretty clever. Harley Davidson might be my favorite. Hog, H-O-G, get it? Harley motorcycles are called hogs. Anyway, getting no points for cleverness, but perhaps points for choosing a company name that will fit neatly in a stock ticker in the first place is Uber, which is expected to start trading tomorrow under the ticker symbol Uber. It's going to be, if forecasts are right, one of the biggest IPOs ever, but maybe not as big as it might have been. Shares of its much smaller rival Lyft have taken a beating since it went public back in March, so Uber has been tempering traders' valuation expectations. We asked Marketplace's Ben Bradford to explain how those expectations get set anyway.
Once a company starts publicly trading, the market decides what stock price it'll bear. But before it goes public, the company decides its own offering price through a wonky technical process, right?
It's more an art than science.
It's definitely more of an art.
It's more art than it needs to be.
University of Florida finance professor Jay Ritter at the end there says there's some scientific basis. The company hires underwriters, banks, that look at the value of similar companies and global market conditions to set a share price. Now, the company wants to make as much money as possible, meaning hires usually better.
On the other hand, they don't want the embarrassment and potential lawsuits if the price drops precipitously.
As happened with Lyft. Meanwhile, Santosh Rao at Manhattan Venture Partners, you heard from him first, says investors want to get in cheap, mostly.
Some investors just want to get in there, that you get bragging rights other than the fact that they are good investments.
But Rao says even this push-pull between company and prospective IPO investors is guesswork.
You're betting on a future that has not yet happened.
And Uber's future includes heavy bets on autonomous vehicles and keeping its current drivers as independent contractors. Matt Kennedy at Renaissance Capital, we also heard him at the top.
Uber could be the world's global transportation platform, or it could be a dud.
So rather than a precise assessment of value, that IPO price is a dart throw at a sweet spot somewhere between luring in investors and leaving money on the table. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
That Uber IPO isn't the only San Francisco company going public in 2019. Lyft, Levi's, and Pinterest have all had their initial public offerings the past couple of months. Airbnb, Slack, and Postmates still to come. And that wave of IPOs has gotten a lot of people speculating about what all that fresh capital might do to San Francisco's already high-priced housing market. So we called some people with an insider's perspective.
My name's Carrie Goodman. I'm a realtor with Sotheby's International Realty.
Cynthia Cummins. I'm the founder of Kindred SF Homes.
My name is Matt Gomez. I work at Vanguard Properties.
We sell real estate in the city of San Francisco.
At all price points right now, there's definitely a conversation about the IPOs.
Whenever I meet somebody in an open house, instead of saying, "Do you have an agent representing you?" my first question is, "Are you about to come into a large sum of money because of an IPO?" I'm joking.
So with all the IPOs coming up, it's a lot of hype.
There's so much excitement and rumors and talk.
We have these conversations, you know, I would say almost every day.
I got a call from two sellers and from two buyers.
They'll come at me and they'll say, "Hey, Matt, what's going on? Do we need to do something about this before it's too late?"
The seller's wanting to know, should we hurry up and sell or should we wait?
Thinking that there's going to be some huge uptick in pricing.
I have a client who is holding off on listing their property because they want to wait for the IPOs.
There definitely is an urgency for buyers to get into the marketplace. Just recently, I closed two transactions. Originally, we started looking for homes that were move-in ready. Both of these clients ended up compromising and buying a house that needed work, but happy that they got into the market before the IPO money came.
And then I got a call from one person who's selling and buying, and she didn't know what in the world to think.
I think that the money that's coming is definitely very real, and the competition that will be in the marketplace is very real.
When you're selling a house in San Francisco, it's already like you've got a really beautiful gift underneath the Christmas tree. But in this case, there's an extra shiny bow on it.
Whether or not we'll see prices go up, you know, I don't have a crystal ball.
So it's impossible to say.
Nobody knows what the future is going to bring.
That was Carrie Goodman with Sotheby's International Realty, Matt Gomez with Vanguard Properties, and Cynthia Cummins with Kindred SF Homes. As with most other slices of this economy, the adult beverage preferences of the average American consumer is a changeable thing. The National Beer Wholesalers Association says big-name brewers are losing market share in that adult beverage market. And although microbrew sales are still growing, the pace of that growth is slowing down. So, enter now the new kid on the block, craft spirits. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen has more on what happens when consumers are thirsty for something new.
It's Mike Mosier's job to know what people are drinking these days.
In my father's era or my grandfather's era, they started with a Schlitz in their hand and a bottle of 10 High whiskey, and they died with it in their hand. That's all they drank.
Mosier follows drinking trends in his job with the Wyoming State Liquor Association. He says younger generations might have favorite brands, but they also want to try out new things.
Where the real drop is in premium beer categories, Budweiser, Coors, etc. They've been down every year for a while.
Down by almost a 10% share of the beer market since 2010. Steve Froome, age 40, is bartending at Weldworks Brewery in Greeley, Colorado. Across from the bar are tables, a couple pinball machines, and one wall covered floor to ceiling with wooden barrels where some of the beers are aged. He hands me a small glass filled with an orange-tinted beer.
This beer we release on our first anniversary, and since then it has launched us in a trajectory upwards.
Whoa. I don't think I've had an IPA that tastes like that.
Isn't that good?
The beer is called Juicy Bits.
It's almost like adult Kool-Aid.
Weldworks has one tap room, though it sells its beer in stores throughout the state. But it's got plenty of competition. Walk a few blocks in many Rocky Mountain communities, and you'll run into breweries. Now there's a new player to compete with, Crafted Distilled Spirits. Crafted typically means it's produced in smaller batches than your bigger name brands that are made in bulk. It's the kind of drinks made by Chad Pollock. He and his family own and operate Backwards Distilling in Casper, Wyoming.
When we first started, it was kind of a novelty, and I think it's becoming more of a thing that people generally accept as something they're going to drink, as opposed to just being kind of cute and fun.
A lot of Backwards liquor is circus-themed. So there's a strongman gin that the company describes as having a bold, piney flavor, and then a contortionist gin that's more botanical. Both go for about $40 a bottle. In 2014, when Backwards Distilling opened up shop, Pollock says there were fewer than 300 craft spirit distilleries in the U.S. Today, there are more than 1,800.
So we are, I would say, maybe like 15 years behind where craft beer is.
Though distillers are popping up in some trendy neighborhoods around the country, craft spirits still don't have the following that craft breweries do quite yet. So if producers want to get the customer's attention, Pollock says they'll have to branch out from the standard spirits like vodka, gin, or whiskey.
I think that you're going to start to see some really cool, innovative spirits that you haven't heard of before.
In Laramie, Wyoming, at Front Street Tavern, it's busy for a weeknight. The bar offers both craft beer on tap and cocktails made with craft liquor. Alicia Zuniga, age 30, is sitting at the bar. She's just got off work from her job as a cook at another restaurant in town. She's drinking one of the older labels, Pabst Blue Ribbon.
When I come here, I'm like, I need to choose between a cocktail or a beer. Today was a beer.
Still, Zuniga is just the type of customer both craft spirit and craft beer producers are after. That's because she's willing to try new drinks that are a little unusual. When asked about some of the concoctions out there, say a Neapolitan ice cream sour beer or ancho chile liqueur, she says she'd be up for one.
Anytime I get to like choose from a list of different drinks, I'm like, ooh, which one's the best one? Ooh, I don't know. I want to try all of them.
And if she likes the way it tastes?
Great, I'll buy two.
That's the kind of customer response that could keep craft beer and liquor makers competing to create something new. In Laramie, I'm Maggie Mullen for Marketplace.
Coming up,
they will be jockeying for, you know, that spot on that climber's chalk bag in the Olympics, I'm sure.
One sport's Olympic debut and the economic payoff that might bring. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's down 138 today at the bell, 0.5%, 25,828. The NASDAQ shed 32 points, about 0.4%, 79.10. The S&P 500 slipped 8 points, 0.3%, landed at 28.70. Today's winners, Chevron, which said today it is not going to be buying Anadarko Petroleum. Shares of Chevron rose 3.1%. Tapestry, the fashion conglomerate that includes the brands Coach and Kate Spade, reported better than expected earnings. Tapestry up 8.5%. Chemical company Dow closed up 0.8%. Today, technology and industry, you ask? Sure. They're still feeling the woes of China trade anxiety. Chipmaker Intel down 5.3% today. 3M down about 1.8%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note that Justin Ho was telling us about, down to 2.45%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every once in a while, we see a Twitter thread, one of those tweet series that tell a story about, I don't know, how Jay Powell came to be the chairman of the Fed, or maybe about very specific kinds of British cheese, and we think that'd be pretty good radio. So today, a thread from Elizabeth Cronise McLaughlin. By day, she's the founder of the Gaia Project for Women's Leadership. All the time, though, she is a mom. So here you go.
Let me tell you a little story about the American medical system circa today. This morning, at 5:30 a.m., both my kids woke up not feeling exactly great. At 8 a.m., we were second in line at urgent care. Turns out both kids need a relatively common antibiotic to be cleared in order to go to school tomorrow, as do I, as a preventative measure. The prescription gets called into the pharmacy across the street from the urgent care. We swing by the pharmacy and realize it doesn't open until 11 a.m. I take the kids for a haircut, we go to the supermarket, we go for a walk, and then we go back to the pharmacy. When we arrive, we learn that this pharmacy is no longer stocking the antibiotic. The closest pharmacy stocking it is 21 miles away and has only one dose. I game which kid is sicker, and it's obvious, resign myself to keeping the other kid home, and pile everyone in the car. We get to the second pharmacy. They have one dose. However, the kid who needs it most isn't showing up on my insurance, for which I pay, wait for it, $1,182 a month under Obamacare. I call the urgent care and get them to clear it with my kid's insurance. This takes 5 separate phone calls. The pharmacy then tells me that while the kid is now showing up on our insurance, insurance is saying it won't cover the antibiotic. But if I want to buy the one pill, it will cost $533 out of pocket. The second pharmacy tells me it will fax the urgent care to ask for a substitute. I call to confirm, and this takes 6 more phone calls. By this time, it's 1:45 p.m. The urgent care finally forwards a substitute for all 3 of us. However, wait for it, pharmacy number 2 doesn't stock the replacement. Plus, even though I and both my kids are on the same insurance plan, they're showing that for the replacement, my daughter has an $80 copay, but my son has a deductible that the insurance company claims is unpaid, and I owe some random number in the middle. This makes no sense. I burst into tears in front of the pharmacist. He finds me a third pharmacy, another 20 miles away. However, pharmacy number 3 has only half the total doses that we need. So I will have to come back for the second round in a few days. I get into the car and again start sobbing over the steering wheel in front of my kids. My kids are starving and mad and don't understand why this is happening. We get to pharmacy number 3 and are finally able to get the medicine for all 3 of us. My daughter's is $80, my son's is $280, and mine is $138.73. It is exactly the same medicine at the same dose. I am a single mother. I am privileged enough to be able to afford any insurance at all. Our total bill today was $498.73. It took more than 7 hours to get the basic medicine that my kids need to be cleared to go to school tomorrow. I'm going to have to fight my insurance on the cost.
That was Elizabeth Cronies McLaughlin. She is at EC McLaughlin on Twitter. If you've seen a good thread you might like to hear on the air, let us know. You can tweet the program at Marketplace. You can get me at Kai Rizdahl. You know, rock climbing just ain't what it used to be. I mean, yes, devotees can still go out in the mountains and do their thing, but it does seem to have come a long way from its roots. Rock climbing has become a social media thing. Many a documentary has been made, and now it's going to be in the Olympics, the 2020 Games in Tokyo. Surely a sign a sport has arrived, athletically and economically. Andrew Bisharat has covered climbing for National Geographic. He is a climber himself. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Can you help me understand how we got from rock climbing the way I think probably most people think of it, which is people going out into the woods and the mountains and climbing rocks, to competitive rock climbing like we're going to do in the Olympics?
Yeah, it's been, the sport of climbing is hundreds of years old. To see it transition to this thing where people are going to be competing on plastic holds in an Olympic setting has been quite a transition that's really rapidly taken place in the last few years.
Do we have, in competitive climbing today, are there like corporate sponsorships, and are we going to see climbers wearing jerseys or, you know, chalk bags with logos on them? I mean, USA Climbing has signed a deal with ESPN, right? A broadcast deal.
Yeah, absolutely. Climbers have big sponsors, and they will be jockeying for, you know, that spot on that climber's chalk bag in the Olympics, I'm sure.
So a lot of people probably have seen the film Free Solo with Alex Honnold up on El Cap in Yosemite. That's not what we're talking about here, right? As you said, it's indoors, plastic holds in a gym, and it's all about how fast you get up this 50-foot wall or whatever it is?
Well, there's three disciplines of climbing that are going to be on display in the Olympics. Lead climbing, which is using ropes to climb, you know, a 70-foot wall. There's going to be bouldering, which is climbing up a 15-foot wall. And then there's speed climbing, which is the most Olympic-y event of the three. And the idea is to get to the top of this single route as fast as possible. And it's been done in about 5.5 seconds.
You're a climber. Would you watch this? I mean, I guess you would, right? Because this is your thing.
This is my thing. And yeah, in person, I find climbing events to be really fascinating, great gripping events that really draw you in. On television, it's a little bit more difficult to get engaged by it. And a lot of that has to do with just the level of professionalism that goes into the announcing and the filming and the instant replays. I think climbing is really in the beginning stages of trying to figure out what that formula is.
Were one an elite Olympic level climber, am I making good money?
Well, the climbers who are making big money are the ones who are doing really extraordinary things outdoors.
Yeah.
A competition climber who's, you know, placing high in some of the international events. They're probably not making much more than $20,000 or $30,000 a year.
Right, right. Andrew Bisharat, he's a writer. His work has appeared in National Geographic, among other places, and also a climber. Andrew, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, a little bit of perspective on the tariffs, the import taxes that the president has put on half of everything that we import from China that may or may not go from 10 to 25% come 12:01 a.m. tomorrow morning. I just wanted to point out that while trade wars are in fact bad and not easy to win, and that precipitous tariff increases do nothing good for the global economy, even a 25% tariff on $200 billion worth of imports, and that is what we're talking about here, even that only comes to $50 billion, which in a $19 trillion American economy just isn't all that much. Context matters. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's down 138 today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ off 32 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 slipped 8 points, 0.3%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bikella, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.